Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On Connect the Dots, every week we talk with different experts about the various facets of our world, which are all interconnected, although we perceive them as separate, everything that connects to our personal health and our total health environment. And that means the health of our water, air, food, the health of our communities, the health of our inner selves, the health of our politics and our society. Every week on Connect the Dots, we take the temperature of how we are doing in terms of making social choices that are pro-health or undermining health. And we discuss a range of different issues that we need to be on top of as citizens as well as health seekers in order to create a healthy society and a healthy and sustainable world. So every week on Connect the Dots, that's what we're talking about. And I also feature actions so that you can learn more about a lot of the issues that that are facing our health and the health of our communities and children today. And I also, there are opportunities as well for you to learn as well as to take action. And actually, one of the things that we've covered on the show quite extensively this last 6 months or more is Proposition 37 in California, the right to know whether genetically engineered foods are in the foods that we buy. And this is the labeling initiative in California, which is a powerful leverage for a healthier food supply. So today on Connect the Dots, we'll be featuring more information about this and more opportunities for taking action and being part of it. And you can do this even if you're not in California. And so listen up. Today I'm very honored to have on the program someone who is a real pioneer in talking about giving us a meta picture of what's going on with our food supply. He's not only a pioneer in doing that, one of the very handful of people who, going back 25 or 30 years, was going beyond telling people what's healthy to eat to really looking at the big picture of how our food choices affect our planet, and the kinds of food choices and policy choices that we need to make personally as citizens, in communities, and in our society to have a healthier food supply. He's John Robbins. He's not only been doing this longer than almost anyone else, but he's been doing it better than pretty much everyone else, too. And that's why I've just been a tremendously great admirer of his work. You may know his very groundbreaking book, Diet for a New America. He's got a new book called No Happy Cows. He's someone that I regularly turn to his wisdom to educate my own understandings about health, and we'll be discussing a range of topics with him on today's show. So honored to, including Proposition 37 and the upcoming Green Festival. So honored to have you today as a guest on Connect the Dots. John, welcome.
Thank you, Allison. I'm very glad to be here.
In a lot of corners, there are people who've gradually become more and more aware and sophisticated that it's not just about choices made at the plate or in the supermarket or the health food store. It's about choices made as a society. Before we get kind of further into the current things we're going to look at today, I'd love to just hear from you your perspective of how far the awareness movement has built since the time that you first began writing about this and covering it.
Well, I see an ever-growing awareness on the part of an ever-increasing number of people that the health consequences of our current policies are taking a tremendous toll and cost us greatly, are bankrupting our society in many ways. We now have the distinction of having become the fattest major nation in the history of the world, with the highest rates of obesity and morbid obesity of any industrialized country in the history of the world. And with each passing year, we're actually becoming even fatter. In 1996, for example, to give some historical perspective here, 16 years ago, the United States already had the highest rate of obesity in the world. And but at that time, there was not a single one of the 50 states with an obesity rate higher than 20%. Now, there's not a single state of the 50 with an obesity rate below 20%. They're all above it. Some are as high as 35%.
Mm-hmm.
We meanwhile, we spend more on health care than any other nation. No one comes close, even.
Mm-hmm.
Per capita, we spend double the amount spent in those countries that, other than us, spend the most, like
mm-hmm.
Germany, Canada, France, and Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
The annual health insurance premiums paid by the average American family today exceed the gross yearly income of a full-time minimum wage worker.
Well,
go ahead.
I mean, that's just an astounding figure right there.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? And it, mm-hmm. it's costing us. I mean, every 30 seconds, someone in the country files for bankruptcy due to the cost of treating a health problem.
Mm-hmm.
The chairman of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, says his company spends more money on health insurance for its employees than it spends on purchasing coffee.
Mm.
Our health care spending is so far out of control. It's really bankrupting not just individuals and families, but companies. The entire economy is buckling under the strain.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation is only getting worse each year. A report earlier this year found that healthcare costs for a typical American family of four were expected to double again in the next 9 years. I mean, this is just not endurable. It's not tolerable. And what I keep wanting us to notice is that in all the heated debate that we have about healthcare reform, one basic fact that I think is singularly important is rarely mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the one thing that could, in fact, dramatically bring down the costs of health care while improving the health of our people. Studies have shown that the single most effective step that most people can take to improve their health is to eat a healthier diet. It's the food. The CDC says that 75% of our health care spending today goes to treat chronic diseases, most of which are preventable and linked to the food we eat.
So you have a certain portion of the population, because you've been writing to them, I've been writing to them promoting these understandings, so there's a certain portion of the population that is keyed into this and that is, you know, kind of fixated about what's on their plate, and they've been thought leaders, or you've been a thought leader and they've been among the early adopters of the principles of healthy eating. But then you have another portion of the population that feels, that hasn't gotten the message or feels that their freedoms are being invaded if they can't have fast food, and doesn't get this connection. And I would, they are still kind of eating along the lines of the sodas and the fast foods and all the rest of it that is contributing to problems. But my perception is, and of course I think it's been improving since when you first wrote your books or your early books, but it's also been a sense of all that I can do as an individual is make my own personal eating choices, and then I've done the job. And, you know, it's not my business, kind of, whatever other people may choose to eat. But it also seems that if we don't, we need to make personal choices, but if we don't make larger systemic choices, we're kind of missing the boat. Do you think that, you know, what is your view of, like, how the interface between the personal choice message and the, the systemic or citizen action message? How do you put those two things together for people?
Well, I think they're both important. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who say we shouldn't take actions socially or politically or economically, mm-hmm. that it's just a question of personal responsibility,
mm-hmm.
and that people, what people eat is their own choice. And that's true, and it's important. Each of us does need to be accountable for the foods we choose to buy and consume.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the government has much business dictating what people should eat.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only half the story. We also have to limit the power that corporations are exerting influencing government policy.
Mm-hmm.
Because very often they use that power to maximize their short-term interests and to diminish or eliminate regulations that would protect workers animals, the environment, and consumers. Mm-hmm. And I always think it's interesting that these same corporations, with all their complaints about government interference and regulation in their activities, they never display any reluctance to benefit from the subsidies and taxpayers' money that their lobbying brings about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, today, Americans spend a smaller percentage of our income on food than any people in the history of the world, and also a smaller amount of our time preparing it, because we eat out so much, and we buy so many packaged foods and prepared foods. We think of this as an achievement. We think of it as a blessing.
Convenience.
It's convenient, and it's inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not widely recognized that it is thanks to our, I consider, deeply misguided farm bills, that it is primarily the unhealthy foods, like feedlot meat and sweetened beverages and processed foods with added sweeteners and fats, that are the ones that are cheap. We've made the least healthy foods the least expensive through our subsidies and policies.
And that is kind of opaque to most people. They just kind of think, you know, there's a big argument. There was a recent sort of confusing and misbegotten Stanford study claiming that there was no greater benefit nutritionally to eating organic foods, for example. So, but we just take it for granted that the healthier, less pesticide-ridden, less antibiotic-ridden growing practices are going to be more expensive than conventional food. But what you're saying is that it's the weight of the subsidies that makes that the case, and that it could be otherwise.
That's absolutely the case. And that Stanford study, I have a lot to say about that if we want to talk about that.
Yes.
But just in a moment, because I want to acknowledge the current farm bill that's up for discussion right now in the Senate and in the House. They have different versions in each house, but both of them have this in common. 70% of the subsidies in those bills, and we are talking about tens of billions of dollars, 70%, actually hundreds of billions of dollars, 70% go to meat and dairy products.
Mm-hmm.
Less than 2% go to help the price, to support the price of vegetables or fruits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that shows you where our priorities are economically.
Mm-hmm.
And we are subsidizing those foods that are high in fat, that cost the environment dearly, that are cruel to animals.
Mm-hmm.
We basically pay, the government pays, that is to say the taxpayer pays,
mm-hmm.
for lowering the costs of the feeds, the soy and the corn, and other feeds that are used as livestock feed in factory farms. They don't pay hardly anything for them, the producers don't. And that enables them to keep their costs down and sell their products cheaply, and we think that's great because we can buy them cheaply. We can go to get a Big Mac or something at Burger King, and it's really cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But it's cheap in the short run.
Mm-hmm.
We spend the least amount of any industrialized country in the history of the world on per capita on food, but we spend the most on health care. Those things are linked.
Mm-hmm.
We are the sickest and fattest people in the world, and we have the cheapest food. And we think it's great that we have cheap food, but it isn't, because it's not really cheap.
Mm-hmm. There's a hidden price tag.
And if you want to see it and expose it and make it visible, just look at the waistlines of
mm-hmm.
the people in our communities, in our cities.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's so much about our environment that we just take for granted. And as regular listeners of this show know, I've done a lot of coverage of food and GMOs, and I also do a lot of coverage on fracking. And, you know, specifically, there's been a lot on the health impacts of it, the environmental impacts of it, the impacts on food and agriculture, because New York State, upstate New York, is a big agricultural state that feeds the city, and there's great concern that fracking will come in and basically pollute the farmlands where New York's sustainable, healthy food is grown. And I've done a lot of coverage of that, but one of the lesser known facts is that the reason the upstate farmers, who are, you know, the minority of people in terms of the overall population, but the majority in terms of those who are itching to move ahead with fracking and to, you know, get their lands leased and frack on their farmlands, one of the reasons the upstate farmers are in this dire strait where they would be bringing toxic chemical poisons into their farmland is because of the Farm Bill and the way the subsidies roll, which work against, you know, they work for huge suppliers of, as you say, dairy and meat, but the smaller artisanal, you know, growers such as exist in New York State have been really driven to the point of bankruptcy.
It's true. It's absolutely true. The Farm Bill is designed by, written for, and constructed to support factory farms, agribusiness, big industrial agriculture, at the expense of family farms, of rural communities, of the environment, and of healthy food. To these people, it's a business, and profit is the prevailing priority.
Mm-hmm.
To the consumer, of course, our health matters, and having clean water matters, and having clean air matters, and having healthy communities and biosystems matter. But to the corporations who are looking just at the numbers and thinking only about next quarter's profits and stock prices and bonuses that they can obtain for the executives,
mm-hmm.
It's a completely perverse sense of criteria to make decisions. But those mm-hmm. are the ones that prevail. Those are the ones that are written into the Farm Bill. Those are the ones that our food supply system now is structured by. And for the individual person, it can seem totally overwhelming.
Right.
The Farm Bill is an enormous document. The amount of lobbying that takes place is just immense. The amount of money that Monsanto has and McDonald's have, and the ads that target children to getting them hooked on junk foods are so pervasive
mm-hmm.
that it can seem overwhelming. And that is why it's so very important that the individual see that their healthiest food choices for you as an individual, as a person, and your family, very often, and this is the powerful thing that I want people to understand, very often are also healthiest for the environment,
mm-hmm.
kindest to the other animals, use the least resources, so food resources, land, energy, water, and so forth, human labor, the inputs that make food production possible, and thus allow the most food resources to be available to feed the hungry.
Mm-hmm.
It is a powerful acupuncture point, your food choices are, where if you make them consciously and eat a non-processed food, a whole foods, plant-strong diet,
mm-hmm.
get as many of your nutrients from plants as possible, don't eat too much, don't eat junk food, don't eat processed foods, what happens is you start to be part of a wave of awakening that's sweeping across the country. You start to be part of a social movement that is gathering strength each time any of us individually takes an action for our own health in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And more people are growing. There is a tremendous growth. This is the powerful and surprising and hopeful thing, is there's a tremendous growth in people who are saying no to Monsanto and no to the Monsanto's efforts really to control not just our nation's but the world's food supply for their own private profit purposes, and saying yes to the actions and the policies that would give us healthy lives, lower healthcare expenses, and a healthier environment.
Mm-hmm. So this is a place where, you know, we're very often taught, you know, we create our own reality, but often in you know, the kind of health and spirituality communities that I have worked in and covered, you know, that comes down to mean, you know, if I maintain my personal sense of emotional well-being, maybe I do that by ignoring what's going on in the society because that's overwhelming or depressing. But, you know, I hear people counseling that all the time, actually.
Well, and, you know, if you want to believe that you create your own reality, there's some truth to that, you know,
mm-hmm.
with the attitudes that we choose to bring to bear on our challenges and difficulties will have a lot to do with how we experience them and how mm-hmm. responsive we are, whether we respond positively or not.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you eat at Burger King, if you eat the standard American diet more or less, I'll tell you who's creating your reality. It's Monsanto. It's Coca-Cola. It's McDonald's. It's the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which represents all the processed foods industries.
Mm-hmm.
They're creating your reality, and they're doing it in an insidious way, because their advertising is so pervasive, their foods are so pervasive. Right now, for most people in this country, it's easier to acquire a pack of cigarettes, to find one, or a candy bar, than it is to find a stalk of broccoli. And by the same token, right now in this country, for most people, it's cheaper per calorie to buy Twinkies than it is to buy carrots.
Wow. Do you have any sense of, like, what percentage of the population is, you know, striving to eat healthy currently and able to? What percentage would like to, but maybe the foods are not available? And what percentage is just kind of ignorance is bliss, and we're eating what's sold to us and then suffering all these ill effects that affect both, you know, the personal health of those involved as well as the health costs of the society? Do you have any sense of how that breaks down in terms
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Just recently, I saw an article about Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Bain Capital was very involved in Monsanto's growth, very involved. Mm-hmm. And Romney's policies would, if he became president, very much acquiesce to Monsanto and industrial agriculture, corporate agriculture. He would probably reduce the very few regulations that we have that protect the environment. And yet, Romney himself, his family itself, eat organic food.
Right.
Now, the same is true about the Obamas, interestingly enough. President Obama, his policies have not done very much to obstruct the ongoing power of Monsanto and industrial agriculture and confined feeding operations, factory farms. But Michelle Obama had planted an organic vegetable garden on the White House lawn, and the Obama family themselves eat organic food. So, you see the disconnect there?
Yep.
I see that as in those two people or families, an illustration of something that's deeply wrong in our society.
Yes.
Where we have it that if you're wealthy or powerful, you can afford it, then you can eat healthy food. But if you aren't, if you're one of the little people, you don't count that much. And that's, I think that's wrong. I think it's terrible. I think it's one of the crimes of our times, but it is part of our cultural trance.
Yes.
And it's one of the things I really want to change. I want organic food, healthy food, to be affordable. I want the healthiest food to be the least expensive. And I have some ideas that are just common sense, I think, for ways we could go about achieving that. And could I'd like to mention them, if I might.
Please, yes.
For example, just to give a few simple examples, what if we taxed white bread and use the revenue from that to subsidize the cost to the consumer of whole wheat bread? So it would raise the price to the consumer of white bread, but lower the price to the consumer of whole wheat bread, whole grain bread.
Mm-hmm.
What if we put a tax on junk food and used that income to lower the cost to everybody of fresh fruits and vegetables? You see, what if we put a tax on pesticide use, and then an herbicide use also, and then used that income, that money, to lower the cost of organic food? I mean, these are ways of not just leveling the playing field, which would actually be a good start, but actually tilting it in the right direction so the healthier foods become the least expensive to people. And then it encourages them to buy them and makes it more possible for everybody at whatever their income level and wherever they're living, be it rural or urban, to have available healthy, fresh, nutritious food. I think everybody would delight in that.
It sounds
really
like a fantastic idea.
I think everybody would be happy with that. You know, people love fresh fruits and vegetables, and when they get them, they're colorful, they're tasty. and they're highly nutritious. But people, if your only food store is a convenience store, if you're in an urban food desert, so to speak, you don't have access to these things.
Right. Also, I think that, I've also done a lot of reporting on toxic chemicals, and of course you're mentioning pesticides and herbicides, and, you know, somehow as part of the PR or public information or disinformation, you know, people have not, they don't want to sort of wake up one day and understand that we have an array of toxic chemicals, the ones that are used in agriculture. There are others in personal care products. There are industrial chemicals, such as those used in fracking and in the energy and other industries. And suddenly we've kind of given them a free pass for a long time. And so it's kind of brutal, I think, for people to wake up and suddenly realize, oh, my God, there could be a lot of different chemicals combining to produce health problems and that I may be ingesting. And it's a scary thought. And they prefer to kind of think, well, if they were bad, they wouldn't be allowed. And then there's a study, like the Stanford study, that kind of...
Exactly. And what you're saying is so true and so important. And I this would be a good point, I think, to talk about that Stanford study.
Do
it's
it.
Being called, by the way, the Stanford Organic Food Study, and that is actually a misnomer. I'm actually doing the keynote next week at the Stanford Food Summit, and I've been very involved in conversations with people at Stanford about that study. It was done by people who work at a health institute at Stanford, but it by no means represents the university or the people there. It's unfortunate that the media has called it the Stanford Organic Food Study, but let's talk about the study. It's gotten a lot of press. There are in the mainstream press, it's been taken to say that organic food is not any more nutritious, it's not any healthier, it's not any safer than conventional food, and therefore the extra costs are not worth it. And that's the implication that the public has been asked to draw from it by the mainstream press. That's not an accurate reading of the study at all, and I want to make this very, very clear. What the study, it's a meta-analysis. They didn't actually do any actual research with food or people, but they studied studies, and they did find that organic food did not seem to be much more nutritious in the sense that it didn't have higher vitamins or content. But there are other studies that do find higher vitamin content and phytochemical content and antioxidant content and higher mineral content to organic food. But the strongest problem with that study is that it actually found that organic food had far less pesticide residues. But it said that the residues that were found in the conventional food, the non-organic food, were within government limits. Therefore, no problem. Those government limits, they don't take you into account the multiple pesticide exposures that we get, as you mentioned, and chemical exposures that we get. They are off. Those limits are often a product of massive industry lobbying. The pesticide manufacturers and agribusiness chemical companies have an enormous vested interest in those allowable limits being as high as possible.
Exactly.
They don't take into account the needs of children very often, or elderly people, or people with weakened immune systems, or people with chronic autoimmune diseases. They are hardly I don't feel that just because it's under federal limits by a little bit, therefore it's totally safe, and that the fact that, and even this study, they found that the organic food had far less pesticide residues, far less insecticides, far less herbicides, than far less. And that would be, of course, expected, because those inputs insecticides and herbicides and pesticides are not allowed in organic agriculture.
Mm-hmm. So in effect, they've kind of bypassed even doing the science to say, are those limits the lower levels or the complete reduction of the no presence of those compared with conventional food, is there a health difference between
exactly they
the
didn't
exposure?
Look at that.
They're not
they just
asking
said,
that question.
Mm-hmm. You know, the study seriously underplayed the benefit of going organic to avoid pesticides.
Right.
And especially, I want to underline this, for vulnerable populations like pregnant women and kids. And they didn't look at the environmental effects of non-organic farming or the human health effects of what happens when agricultural chemicals leach into groundwater and the effects of pesticides on farm workers or the risks of non-organic farms becoming fertile breeding grounds for antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Yeah,
they did find out that there was much less antibiotic-resistant bacteria in organic meats than compared to conventional meats. They did find out that there were far fewer pesticides in organic foods than in conventional foods. But they just assumed that the amount of pesticides in our food is safe because it's, you know, under the regulations. But the regulations are no guide to health. They're really a political construct, and they're the outcome of enormous pressure that mm-hmm. the agrochemical companies have exerted on our public policies.
Yes, and that's something also that's very relevant to the GMO issue. And
yes.
We have to take a break here for station identification. But I think the whole way that, you know, the failure of science and the assumptions about public policy that we are discussing, that you've just laid out so brilliantly, kind of, you know, also play out in that. So let's discuss that in the second half of the show. And listeners, please stay with us here and Connect the Dots. It's Allison Rose Levy, and I'm speaking with John Robbins. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, Huffington Post, an alternate reporter, 20-some-plus years green and health journalist, and with you every week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays. I'm here today talking with John Robbins here in the second half of our show. He's a wonderful author who's been covering, in a systemic way, helping us really orient ourselves to the nature of our food supply and how it affects our health and the health of the planet. His latest book is called No Happy Cows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Food Revolution. And you can find out more about his books, his talks, his works, follow his blog and radio shows and podcasts on his website, johnrobbins.info / will take you there. And he actually has written over a half a dozen books, many, many books over many years that really have been opening our view to how we can take collective health responsibility in what he, in the first half of the show, called a wonderful acupuncture point, which is making sane personal and public health policy food choices. He's also involved with the Institute for Responsible Technology. You can sign up there by going to http://www.responsibletechnology.org/, and that will take you to a sign up where you can be part of the solution to some of the health and social problems and environmental problems that are coming to us from an unhealthy food supply, which John brilliantly targets and addresses. And we'll continue that discussion in this half of the show. I just also want to highlight, if you're enjoying the show, please, it will be posted on the Progressive Radio Network website under the Connect the Dots archive. Please pass the show along to other people who would benefit and like us on iTunes as well. Also want to highlight, I like to do some of our kind of ads here at the beginning so that we can kind of carry the conversation through to the end. Also want to highlight something that is available right now, and I think through the end of the month of October, that some of our listeners here, you may want to avail yourselves of, and that is you can see the film Genetic Roulette, which is made by Jeffrey Smith, who's also been a leading reporter and journalist looking into the depths of the science of GMOs, which we're going to be discussing in the second half of the show here with John Robbins. And he has also now done a film based on his book. It's called Genetic Roulette, The Gamble of Our Lives. And you can see this film for free right now, as well as take action, by going to http://geneticroulette, which is spelled R-O-U-L-E-T-T-E, movie.com. And so if you're listening to this show, either live or in archives during the month of October 2012, you have a wonderful opportunity to learn more by going and watching that film. And now back to the wonderful conversation we're having with John Robbins today. John, you were saying, you know, that there's a kind of intersect between the science that is or isn't done, which, you know, you were just talking about in terms of some of the failure to probe in the depths of the recent critique of organics as not being nutritionally as valuable as some hoped, but in fact that overlooked pesticides, herbicides, environmental impacts, impacts on vulnerable populations. You know, all that you were discussing in the first half of the show, it seems like we assume that the public policies reflect good science, but that very often the science isn't being done. And
Very often the science is done by industry.
Right.
And they have an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to summarize what happened with this study out of the Institute at Stanford, the public is being told incorrectly that the study found that organic food is not any safer or more nutritious or nutritious, and therefore not worth the extra cost.
Mm-hmm.
How many people who buy organic food do so because they think that there's higher amounts of vitamin A or vitamin C in it? I think most people who buy organic food do so because they think, and correctly so, that there are far fewer, if any, pesticide residues in it. And that's the real power of organic food. There's no implication that it's less nutritious, but it's safer. It's far safer. And I think we have greatly underestimated the damage that we're doing to ourselves and our bodies and our, frankly, our spirits and our biosystems through the onslaught of chemicals that we are perpetrating on the environment, in our food, in our food chains constantly. And organic food, organic agriculture, by greatly diminishing the levels of chemicals and certainly the levels of poisons that are used, have a powerfully wonderful effect on in so many levels. This is what I mean by an acupuncture point, by the way, where the minimum amount of effort, we get a maximum amount of healing benefit to the whole system.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have personally been, you know, eating organic foods and, you know, completely eschewing conventional foods for a couple of decades here. And one of the reasons that I personally have been very concerned about GMOs is because they pose a threat to the organic food supply. So, you know, there's some kind of idea we have because we don't see the kinds of interconnections. Many people, it's hard for us to see the kinds of interconnections that you're tracing here. And therefore, people think, well, I can just go, you know, I'm lucky to belong to the Park Slope Food Co-op, which is, you know, utterly fantastic, oldest food co-op in the U.S., but, you know, we'll tend to think, well, I can choose to eat organic foods, you know, but what happens, you know, but organic foods aren't in a little circumscribed area, you know, where they're completely sacrosanct from other things that happen in nature. And
well, exactly.
So
and
I'd love to hear your
corn.
Take on GMOs as a threat to organic foods, John.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Allison, and a good example is corn, because the vast amount, majority of our corn grown in the United States now is GMO,
mm-hmm.
and it's genetically engineered.
Mm-hmm.
And the pollen from that genetically engineered corn, which of course carries the genetically engineered DNA of the corn, spreads in the wind. And you can't build a wall high enough, if you even try to, around your organic corn field to keep out that pollen.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that is what's happening. There's been a contamination of the organic corn supply and other crops as well by genetic material that's been modified and altered for proprietary purposes. Again, the purpose of genetically engineered food is not to feed the world. They will say that in their PR, although there's no evidence to support it. The reality is that these crops have been genetically engineered to create profit for Monsanto and the others, biotech companies, who want to control the world's food supply. Mm-hmm. They don't want people to know. And I think it's really important that we do know. I think this is a pivotal issue today.
Mm-hmm.
There's a saying that ignorance is bliss. In this case, I don't think there's any truth to that. In this case, I think ignorance is subordination. Ignorance is subservience. Ignorance is acquiescence to Monsanto's agenda. And who is Monsanto? What are they doing this for? I mean, it's really important to understand this. When the first genetically engineered foods started to enter the food supply, it was in the early 90s, mid-90s, and the very first one was Monsanto's genetically engineered bovine growth hormone.
Mm-hmm.
This is their artificial hormone that they engineered, and they'd sell it to big dairies, and the dairies would inject their cows with this hormone, and the animals would produce more milk. Their udders would also become infected and enlarged and distended regularly and infected, by the way, with various infections, that Monsanto, when they delivered the genetically engineered hormone to the dairies, along with it in the same order, sometimes in the same package, would come the antibiotics that Monsanto conveniently also sold to treat the mastitis, the udder infections that predictably occurred when these cows were injected with this hormone. Now, when this was happening, a number of small dairies in the country, some in Vermont in particular, but throughout the country, didn't want to use Monsanto's artificial hormones.
Mm-hmm.
So they would put on the labels of their yogurt or their milk or their ice cream, non-GMO or made without genetically produced hormones or some other statement to accurately inform the public that they didn't use these drugs. Monsanto sued these dairies, one after the other, after the other, after the other, and these dairies could not match the financial clout and the legal power of these of Monsanto, and so they would fold. Some went out of business, some removed the labels, and the labels were accurate, and Monsanto never claimed they weren't. But Monsanto sued these dairies for accurately informing the public that the dairies weren't using Monsanto's product on the grounds, I think this is just so typical, that accurately informing the public was stigmatizing their product.
Wow.
And this is, again, what they're saying in California today with Proposition 37, which would mandate the labeling of GMO foods. They're saying that if you put a label on it, it unfairly stigmatizes it. It implies that it's not as good. Well, people have a right to know. This is the right to know about what's in our food. They don't want us to know. And the reason they don't want us to know is because they know that if we knew, we'd stop buying their products. If we knew, there'd be a revolution. If we really knew what was going on, it's like people used to say, if you ever visited a sausage factory and you saw what really went into the sausages, you wouldn't eat them anymore. People sometimes say if you actually went to a slaughterhouse, you'd be a lot more vegetarians. This is true, and if people understood the realities of GMOs, they wouldn't buy them.
So the label is not just a little tiny piece of paper on your product. It really represents a right to be well informed.
I think so. And in fact, people throughout the country right now can help with Proposition 37 in California. It's really an incredible opportunity to intervene in this whole situation.
How?
And a good website is carighttoknow.org. C-A-R-I-G-H-T-T-O-K-N-O-W writetoknow.org, C-A for California, writetoknow.org.
Yes, we featured them many times on this program, and I'll say what I've said before, which is that, you know, what happens in California, where in the upcoming ballot there's the opportunity to vote for the proposition and have labeling that will allow consumers to know. If it passes in California, it actually, in effect, passes elsewhere. So this is happening in California, but it's a key leverage point for everyone throughout the United States who cares about food quality and the quality of the food supply. So even though some of our listeners, you know, I'm not in California, you can't vote, but you can contribute, you can disseminate via social media, you can talk to other people. What else can people do, John, would you say?
Well, it's very important. You can let people, if you have friends in California,
mm-hmm.
talk to them and alert them to the importance of Proposition 37. It's on the ballot November 6th in California.
Mm-hmm.
And encourage them to sign up for a shift with a phone bank for the campaign. These phone banks will call likely supporters to help get out the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And people in California can do that. People out of state can do that as well. Of course, you can donate money to the campaign, and that's always helpful. I've been doing a lot of fundraisers for this effort.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important that people know. And I want to make something clear. Earlier this year, the states of Vermont and Connecticut each came very, very close, to passing GMO labeling bills. And in both instances, what took place was that Monsanto put tremendous pressure. In one case, it was a governor, and in the other case, it was a key person in the state legislature who decided to fold, who recognized that the people of the state overwhelmingly wanted the labeling, but faced with Monsanto's pressure, they did not want to expose and burden the citizens of the state with the financial costs that would have incurred in having to fight Monsanto in court. In other words, Monsanto intimidated states, two of them, and they buckled and they suppressed the legislation. Now,
wow.
Vermont and Connecticut, it's astounding that a corporation could do that, and it's wrong that they should be allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
But Vermont and Connecticut are small states compared to California.
Mm-hmm.
The size of California's economy and the amount of food produced in California that's eaten nationwide is so great that if Prop 37, a bill that would require GMO food to be labeled, passes, and there is a good chance right now that it will, although it's not a slam dunk, there's no way Monsanto can intimidate the California economy the way they overwhelmed Vermont and Connecticut. It's just this, the size issue is too disproportionate there. It's very important that we get this legislation passed.
Yes, you know, there are many issues out there, but the issues where, and you know, sometimes an issue starts as a small thing and for many years people are, you know, yelling about it and not everybody's heard about it beyond a small minority, but when it gets to this point with this size state and all that's entailed there, it does become a leverage point, and it's a vital thing to whatever your specific actions or activist causes are for any listeners, because this is an activist group, to support the leverage causes as well as your own causes. And this is certainly a key leverage point for both food and health. Now, I also want to mention that you are going to be speaking and presenting at upcoming green festivals in California. These follow the election, but if you're in San Francisco, Los Angeles, or can get there, it's going to be wonderful. You'll be able to hear John Robbins and a whole host of other wonderful speakers. The San Francisco Green Festival is happening November 10th and 11th, and John will be speaking on that Saturday. And in Los Angeles, the The Green Festival is occurring on November 17th and 18th at the Los Angeles Convention Center. And again, there, John will be speaking on Saturday. And you can find out more about Green Festivals. Maybe we'll have you come to New York, hopefully, this time as well, at www.greenfestivals.org to hear John Robbins in person. And once again, mentioning your Food Revolution Network, which is available online where people can sign up at www.foodrevolution.org. That sounds really good to me. Now, listen, John, we have just another 6 or 7 minutes or so before we sail out of this edition of Connect the Dots, and I just, you know, wanted to just get a little bit of your understanding about what some of the health risks of consuming GMOs might be. You know, they were kind of given a free pass by the FDA, saying, oh, they're pretty much the same as other foods. But there has been, I mean, what is the evidence showing as it creeps in? Is there science that kind of gives pause or cause for concern about just freely consuming them?
Well, yes, there is tremendous cause for concern. And yes, you're right, the FDA gave them a free pass and said they're substantially equivalent, that's the phrase they used, to conventional foods, and therefore did not require pre-market testing for health risks. They just let them enter the food supply carte blanche. But there have been some health studies, particularly on lab animals, and every animal tested shows liver damage, shows digestive system disturbances, shows birth defects, shows increased cancer rates, shows the growth of tumors, shows breakdowns of critical systems in their bodies, shows early deaths. I mean, it's astounding to me that with the few experiments that we have, and we certainly need more, but we don't need them in animals, we need them in people. But, you know, there is an experiment going on with people, and we're all guinea pigs in it. But the problem is there's no surveillance. Mm-hmm. In a test study where you expose some animals to or give them food that's one per type, and then you have a control group and you see what the difference is, you're analyzing the differences. You're trying to discover what the consequences are of the two directions or two levels of exposure, whatever is being tested. Currently, we're all being guinea pigs, but no one's watching. There's no surveillance. There's no one's learning anything from it. Mm-hmm. And yet, what we're seeing, and this is correlative exactly to the introduction of GMOs in our food supply, we're seeing greatly increased levels of food allergies, greatly increased levels of autoimmune diseases, greatly increased levels of colitis and irritable bowel, and all kinds of digestive aberrations. There is evidence that GMO corn, which has been engineered to produce pesticides in every cell of the plant, that genetic material migrates into our intestines, and our intestines can become living pesticide factories.
Oh my gosh!
Yes, it's really out of a horror movie. Mm. Some people call these Frankenfoods, and I think that isn't too far-fetched, because in the story of Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, the original story, what you had was a scientist who, without really thinking about it, produced a monster. And it wasn't that he was an evil scientist. It wasn't that he was trying to cause damage. It was that he was just playing in his laboratory, and he created a monster. And I think with GMOs, that's what's happened. Their intention was never to help people. It was never to increase yields or increase nutrient profiles, and it doesn't do, none of their products do that. But what they did want to do was create greater markets for their herbicides, and that they have done. What they did want to do was profit from people's purchasing of seeds and greatly increase those profits, and that they have done. That's what GMOs are all about. The private agendas of Monsanto and similar companies, the public health, the general welfare, the well-being of our societies and our bodies and our future, really requires that we stop this technology, that we truly study it. We've given it a green light. We've given it a free pass. We need to begin the stop of stopping it. We need to get labeling.
And
people
this is
have
our
a right
start.
To know.
This is our start. So California Right to Know, and you know, get involved, listeners. Thank you so much, John Robbins, for being with me today, and our listeners on Connect the Dots. John Robbins is the author of the recent No Happy Cows. Foodrevolution.org is his website, where you can also get involved. Thank you for your insights, and love to have you back again. Californians, see John at Green Festival. Go to greenfestivals.org. Thank you, John, for being on the show with me today.
Thank you, Allison.
And listeners, stay tuned next week at Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, for the next edition of Connect the Dots.